Three, Makarios' work remained in the shadow until the second half of the 16th century. In 1552, the Jesuit Francisco Torres, known as Turianus, drew from the manuscript of the Apocryphicos, which at that time was in San Mark's library in Venice, but which is now lost, to reinforce his arguments against the Protestants in the Eucharistic controversy. In 1867, Charles Blondel found an early modern copy in Athens. Blondel transcribed the manuscript and prepared it for publication. On his premature death, Makarios' apologetical treatise was published by his friend, Paul Foucart, in 1876. Since its first publication, the Apocryphicos has not ceased to attract the scholar's interest, mainly because of the refined anti-Christian attacks it preserves. Most readers have therefore focused on uncovering the identity of the anonymous Hellene, whose anti-Christian critique is refuted by Makarios. As Richard Boulet accurately observes, in this attempt, two major hindrances have to be overcome. First, the fact that Makarios reformulates and reorganizes the pagan objections. Second, our restrained knowledge of anti-Christian literature in the 3rd and 4th centuries. Despite these difficulties, various hypotheses have been advanced with respect to the opponent's identity, that he is Oceanos Hierocles, Porphyry of Tyre, Iamblichos, or even the Emperor Julian. Adolf von Harnack has connected the Hellenes' objections with Porphyry's work against the Christians, without, however, positing they preserved the philosopher's successima verba. Harnack's influential reconstruction has been brought into question by Barnes and others. Nevertheless, the Porphyrian origin of the pagan objections is still widely accepted. It is not my aim here to enter into the debate concerning the identity of the opponent. However, since this identity has not so far been established beyond doubt, the possibility that the Apocryphicos contains a variety of sources remains open. This means that Makarios would have drawn his material, from a variety of pagan authors, including Porphyry, or from earlier Christian refutations. In the case of Porphyry, such refutations could include Methodius of Olympus, Eusebius of Caesarea, and Apollinarius of Laodicea, or even from an anthology of pagan objections to Christianity. The latter hypothesis has been advanced by Corsaro. Whatever the case may be, whether the existence of an anthology is posited or not, the fact is that the possibility of a variety of sources cannot be excluded. In other words, it is not impossible that the opponent is a literary construction which combines anti-Christian views belonging to different pagan authors, rephrased and refuted by Makarios in a work meant to be an overall denial of various Neoplatonic objections to Christianity. Thus, I submit that the only secure way to determine the origin of the pagan views in the Apocryphicos is a careful analysis of each of them. On this point, I agree with Richard Boulet, who, with respect to the presumed Porphyrian origin of the objections, notes, I'm quoting, "Ce n'est que par l'étude de chaque passage, et grâce à la comparaison avec d'autres témoignages, que l'on peut espérer établir l'origine porphyrienne de telle ou telle critique." Following this idea, in this talk I will focus on the passages concerning the debate over the cult of the statues and the doctrine of incarnation. In the first part, I will examine the objections of the anonymous Hellene and will show they derive from Porphyry of Tyre. In the second part, I will concentrate on Makarios' answers. Since the issues his reply to the first objection raises are outside the scope of this talk, because he deals with the meaning of of anthropomorphism in the Bible and the angel's visit to Abraham, I will primarily focus on his response to the alien's second objection. More precisely, I will argue that Makarios' answer is forced to be a refutation of Porphyrian views, and that in refuting Porphyry, Makarios elaborates a Christian concept of theurgia by exploiting Iamblichan ideas. The objections. In their commentary on the Hellenes' objections with respect to the status of the gods, Richard Boulez and Mark Edwards draw attention to a number of parallels from Celsus, Julian, and Porphyry. These parallels show clearly the thematic unity of the defense of the Greco-Roman religion against Christianity. Concerning Celsus, Boulez against the Palma di Caesar observes that the similarities are by no means enough to support the view that Makarios drew directly from Origen's opponent. In addition, he points out a series of significant differences between Celsus and the Hellenes, which reveal the essentially different scope of their critique. As for Julian, Boulez generally shows that in most cases his critique depends directly on Porphyry, and that in some cases the same parallel is found both in Porphyry and in Julian. But surprisingly enough, he fails to see that the Hellenes' first objection falls under this latter category. I will come back to this point later. For the moment, let us stay on the correspondences with Porphyrian ideas identified by Richard Boulez and Mark Edwards. With respect to the Hellenes' first objection, Boulez points out one parallel in the first fragment of Porphyry's law treatise on status, that is number one on your handout, which has been almost entirely transmitted as part of the third book of Eusebius of Caesarea's Preparatio Evangelica. Mark Edwards localizes one more correspondence between Porphyry's aforementioned fragment and the first lines of the Hellenes' objection. Regarding the second objection, Boulez draws attention to two citations of Porphyry in St. Augustine's City of God, that is number 24 and 25 in the handout. However, he considers that, like for the rest of the Apocryticos, for the passages we examine here as well, it is impossible to prove their direct dependence from Porphyry. However, it must be observed that Boulez adds a word of caution in which he warns the reader that he has not exploited the entire Porphyrian corpus. In what follows, I will endeavor to show that with respect to the objections relevant to the status of the gods, the similarities with the Porphyrian corpus, not only with the status, but also with the on abstinence and the letter to Anibo and the sentences, go far beyond mere thematic correspondence and constitute therefore sufficient evidence for attributing the Hellenes' view to Porphyry of Tyre. The first objection. I will begin by examining the first objection, which von Harnack has classified as fragment 76 of Porphyry's against the Christians. This is number one on the handout. I might avoid to read it here in order to gain time. So, I will first focus on the parallel pointed out by Boulez in order to show on what grounds Makarios' excerpt relates to Porphyry's fragment. Subsequently, I will argue there are further similarities between the Hellenes' objection and Porphyry's on status. On this basis, I will suggest that the pagan critique derives from Porphyry. In on status, fragments text number 3 and 4 on the handout, Eusebius explicitly claims to be quoting Porphyry's Ipsissima Verba. It has been observed that when making such a claim, the apologist is remarkably faithful to the sources he quotes. It can therefore be admitted that the above fragments preserve Porphyry's own words. Both Porphyrian excerpts refer to the anthropomorphism of the statues in terms clearly evoking those of the opponent. The adjective anthropoides, which describes the human form of the statues, is common in Macarius, number 1, on the handout, and in Porphyrius, number 3, on the handout. The synonym anthropomorphos is used in Porphyry, number 4, on the handout. More precisely, Porphyry argues that the statues are given the anthropomorphic shape because, first, the divine is rational, and this is also the claim in number 4 on the handout, and second, in the divine there is pure beauty. In other words, the human shape of the statue evokes reason, which is the distinctively human feature, and human reason is an image for divine reason. In addition, the human beauty instantiated in the statue is an image of pure divine beauty. The statues are therefore images, icones, in the Platonic sense. They allow the viewer to ascend from the sensible to the intelligible realm, thus having an analogic value. In effect, the term icon occurs throughout Porphyry's fragmentary treatise, and is significantly present in the only surviving fragment of its introduction, that is number 2 on the handout. Like Porphyry in number 3 on the handout, the anonymous Hélène justifies the human form of the sculpted images by referring to beauty. He thus remains faithful to the Platonic tradition in linking beauty and divine goodness and in positing that the statue's human beauty is an image of divine beauty. Furthermore, he explains the statue's anthropomorphism by reminding that humans are considered to be an image of God. Icon Theou. It is not necessary to suppose that in order to show, like Celsus, that the Christians contradict themselves, the Hélène alludes to the biblical expression katikona, which expounded by the Platonic sense of icon involved in Christian theological developments the rationality of human nature in conformity with God's paradigm. He could simply be alluding to the Platonic notion of godlikeness, which requires the subjection of the irrational parts of the soul to the rational one. Within this frame, in Porphyry's On Abstinence, number 6 on the handout, the man led by reason is said to be godlike, omnios theo, and enimas, icon, God. Whatever the case may be, the expression icon theou refers to human reason as an image of divine reason. Macarius' passage can therefore be considered as a perfect parallel for Porphyry's text 3 on the handout, and in addition as reminiscent of Porphyry's use of icon theou in the De Abstinentia. However, this is not the only correspondence with Porphyry, nor the most significant one. For Eusebius' word-by-word quotation of the first lines of Porphyry's On Statues presents some even more striking similarities with the Hélène's objection, which I submit demonstrate convincingly the latter's Porphyrian origin. This parallel has already been localized by Mark Edwards. In what follows, I propose a thorough analysis which expands his remark. In text number 2 on the handout, Porphyry says that the statue, the Xoanon, is not only wood and stone, as the most uneducated thing. Similarly, the opponent says wood and stone and bronze are only what the statue is made of. That is, they are not what the statue is. But he also states that these materials are not the dwellings of the gods. More precisely, according to the opponent, those who give appropriate reverence to the gods know that the god is not in the material from which his statue is fashioned. It should first be noted that the opponent's statement, namely that the gods are not in their material statues, is distinct from the statement that the gods are not identical to their statues, which is made, for example, by Celsus, and which repeats an assertion dating back to Heraclitus of Ephesus. Porphyry does not explicitly claim that the gods are not in their statues. However, he clearly does not share this view. First, in his own statues, he understands the statues to be icones, images of divine powers, which is of course very different from claiming that the statues are receptacles of the gods. Second, it is not impossible that in the lost parts of his treatise, he refuted clearly the view that the gods can dwell within their statues. Following Dodds and Thanaseanu Dobler, I consider that the latter view is supported by Iamblichus in a disputed passage of his De Mysteriis, which is number 7 on the handout. In fact, the animation of statues is a part of theurgy, which Iamblichus defends against Porphyry's critique in his De Mysteriis. Porphyry's opposition to theurgy is well known. His main concern against it derives from the principle that, as opposed to the demons, the gods are incorporeal. Number 8 and 9 on your handout. Given that all incorporeals are impassible, number 10 and 11, if the gods are incorporeal, they are impassible. As numerous quotations deriving from the letter to Anibo and preserved in Iamblichus De Mysteriis show, Porphyry would have particularly insisted on the impassibility of the divine, which was, according to him, compatible with the theurgic practices. This is text 12 to 16. In fact, since the Passion is the road to corruptibility, I'm quoting sentence 21, which is 8. This is number 11 on the handout. So, since for Porphyry the Passion is the road to corruptibility, the gods' impassibility entails their incorruptibility. But if the gods are incorruptible, it is impossible that they become involved in theurgic rites in order, for example, to inhabit a material statue, since this would be tantamount to their descending into the material world, which is a world of corruption and saints, number 17 on the handout. And again, given their impassibility, the gods cannot be seduced or compelled. On the same grounds, they cannot receive orders by men as if they were inferior to men. Furthermore, according to Porphyry, the efficacy of such rites is strictly limited to the lower part of the soul and does not result in union with the divine, as the theurgists pretend. This is number 19, a quotation from Augustine. For Porphyry, the higher level is attained through virtue alone, which involves vegetarianism and continence. For the above reasons, Porphyry would have undoubtedly reject the theurgic rite of the animation of statues. For him, the gods could by no means be in the wood or the bronze or the stone. As a passage of the De Abstinentia shows, for Porphyry, who remains faithful in Plato and Plotinus, the only, so to speak, animate statue is the philosopher, who while still embodied becomes divine through virtue alone. This is number 20. On these grounds, in a forthcoming paper, I propose that the ambiguous lost work on statues, which according to Photius was refuted by Philoponus, might have been written as a response to Porphyry's on statues in order to defend the view that the statues can be appropriate receptacles of the gods against the Porphyrian view of statues as images or symbols of divine powers. Thus, to summarize, the opponent's statement that the gods are not in the material statues is in agreement with what Porphyry seems to have argued for within the frame of his rejection of theology. Furthermore, the extant fragments of the on statues make clear that the notions of power, dynamis, and image, icon, had a key role in Porphyry's original account. Behind every god, Porphyry sees a power, and the statues are conceived as images or as symbols of powers. It is therefore significant that both terms, dynamis and icon, occur in Makarios. The reference to power is even more noteworthy because it is peculiar to Porphyry's interpretation of the divine statues. More precisely, like Porphyry, the Hellene attributes a power to the god and sees a link between this power and the god statue. Moreover, he considers that the divine power is not affected by the statue's breaking off. Of course, if an image is destroyed, this does not entail that the model the image refers to, be it a power or an object or anything else, is also destroyed. Thus, if the statues are images of powers, their destruction does not entail the dissolution of the power. But it might be also of interest to remind in passing that for Porphyry, powers are by no means corruptible since they are incorporeal, belonging either to the transcendent and per se incorporeals or to the immanent incorporeals. Thus, the Hellenes' reference to powers and images with respect to the statues of the gods points directly towards Porphyry's own statues. Furthermore, the occurrence of the word "hypomnesis," translated as memorial by Mark Edwards and Jeremy Scott, in Makarios, fits well within the scope of Porphyry's The Statues. According to the Hellene, the statues serve as reminders, hypomnesio Seneca, recalling the qualities of each deity and inviting into theological reflection. As Krulak observes, the comparison between on one hand the statues and on the other written characters or letters and books in text 2, that is in Porphyry's The Statues, has its origin in the comparison between painting and writing in Plato's Phaedrus. In this dialogue, the term hypomnema refers to the function of writing. Thus, it would have been natural for Porphyry to use in one of his work's lost parts hypomnema and by extension the related term hypomnesis to describe the function of the images, like the anonymous Hellene does. Last but not least, an extract from Julian's letter to a priest, number 5 of the handout, is an echo of both Porphyry's number 1 in the handout and Makarios. This correspondence indicates that most likely Makarios' passage comes from Porphyry as well. For all the above reasons, I think that the pagan objection derives from Porphyry. Makarios could have drawn either directly from Porphyry or from Eusebius' refutation of Porphyry's on statues, or even from an anthology. Of course, Eusebius' Preparatio Evangelica would have been more easily accessible than Porphyry's original work. Thus, setting aside the possibility of Makarios using an hypothetical florilegium, Eusebius would be the most probable source. However, it is not impossible that Makarios, like many of his contemporaries, knew Porphyry at first hand. The question that subsequently arises concerns the relation of the advanced of the adversary's objection with Porphyry's against the Christians. It is not necessary to posit such a relation, since Makarios could have simply been paraphrasing Porphyry's De Statuis as quoted by Eusebius. But on the other hand, there are no grounds for excluding such an association. The complex debate over Porphyry's against the Christians remains open. Is the Adversus Christianus to be considered as a single work, as Vissar Boulet, Christophe Rydwick and Aaron Johnson believe, or is it rather to be understood as a massive one that is a collection of anti-Christian material scattered throughout the Porphyrian corpus, as Pierfranco Beatrice, Mark Edwards and Robert Berkman argue? A survey of these discussions is beyond the scope of my talk. It can, however, be observed that in the former case, that is, in the case in which the Adversus Christianus is considered as a single work, a hypothetical relation between it and the pagan objection would be conceivable if one posited that in this work, Porphyry referred to the cult statues, resuming the views he had exposed in detail in the statues. In the latter case, a conjectural link between the pagan objection and the Adversus Christianus would be possible if one postulated that some extracts of the statues were part of Porphyry's library against the Christians, as Beatrice has proposed. Whatever the case may be, there is sufficient evidence, I think, for attributing the adversary's first objection with respect to the statues of the god to the philosopher of Tyre. In what follows, I will argue that this is also the case with the second objection regarding the statues and the Christian doctrine of incarnation. In the second objection, the Hellene refutes the idea that the gods can inhabit their statues and the Christian doctrine of the incarnation on the same grounds. I'm quoting. But if one of the Hellenes is so empty in his opinions as to think the gods reside within the statues, how much purer is the thought of one who believes that the divine entered into the womb of Mary the Virgin and became an embryo, and once born was swaddled, covered with the blood of afterbirth, and by, and with things still much more incongruous than this. In other words, the adversary's claim is the following. Even those among the Hellenes who are so empty in their opinions as to think that the gods enter and reside within the statues, have clearer ideas than the Christians, who believe that the god entered the womb of the Virgin and was subjected to all that which material generation involves. Both ideas are inconsistent, but the latter is even more absurd. With respect to Porphyry's opposition to theurgy, and subsequently to the theurgic rite of the animation of statues, which results in the gods inhabiting the statues, sufficient evidence has been given above. With regard to his rejection of the incarnation doctrine, Richard Boulet quotes two excerpts from Augustine's City of God, which Jean Pepin took to belong to Porphyry's Contra Christianus, and which show clearly that Porphyry rejected the incarnation. So number 24 on the handout. But Porphyry was the thrall of malicious powers, and he was both ashamed of them, and at the same time held them in too much awe to dispute against them freely. He chose not to see that the Lord Christ is the principle by whose incarnation we are purified. Indeed, he despised him in the very flesh that he took upon him in order to be sacrificed for our cleansing. And again, number 25. You say it is true that ignorance and the many vices to which it gives rise can never be cleansed by any rites, but only by patrikos nous, that is, the mind or intellect of the Father's will. But you do not believe that this is identical with Christ, for you despise him because of the body that came to him from a woman and because of the reproach of the cross. Of the above extracts, the latter offers a closer parallel to Macarius because of the reference to the body that came to Christ from a woman. It also raises the question concerning the reason why, according to Porphyry, the Incarnation and the Cross are incompatible with the divinity of Christ. For Augustine says that Porphyry did not believe that Christ was the paternal intellect because of his incarnation. The answer is that for Porphyry the divine is impassible, and thus incorruptible. As a result, it cannot be subject to the world of becoming, which is a world of corruption and change. In fact, in sentence 24, which is number 18 on the 17 on the handout, Porphyry makes a clear-cut distinction between, on one hand, the processions of the incorporeal life, that is, the soul and the intellect, and thus the patechosnos mentioned by Augustine, and on the other hand, the generation which is associated with corruption and change, and to which the incorporeal lives can by no means be subject. In other words, Porphyry refutes the incarnation for precisely the same reasons he is opposed to theurgy, and subsequently to the theurgic rite of the animation of statues. The key concept in both cases is the divine's impassibility. But refuting the gods dueling within their statues and the incarnation on the same grounds is precisely what the unnamed Hellen does. Thus, the Hellen's objection is not only faithful in Porphyry's rejection both of the animation of statues and of the incarnation, but also consistent with Porphyry's rejection of the theurgical rite and the Christian objection, the Christian doctrine, on the same grounds. This evidence is, I think, sufficient for attributing the second objection to Porphyry of Tyre. Before moving on to Macarius' response, there is one more question to answer. Why is Christ's entering into the womb of Mary considered to be even more incongruous than the gods entering in the material statues? I believe that the reason for this is the fact that, according to Porphyry, entering into the womb, being born, and dwelling within a human body would have been considered as involving even greater subjection to passion, even inferior passions, even worse corruption and change than entering into a statue and dwelling within it. One can think of the body changes during pregnancy and pains for giving birth, and then the new human being subject to old age and disease. So there is even greater passion and change and corruption than in the case of entering into a statue. That's all. Furthermore, as the emphasis put on the virginity of Mary indicates, the virginal conception of Christ might have been a supplementary reason making the Christian doctrine sound even more incongruous. In the second part of my talk, I will focus on Macarius' response to the objections of the adversary. In his response to the opponent's first objection, which is the passage the Byzantine iconoclast used against the cult of the icons, Macarius is primarily concerned with the last part of the objection concerning anthropomorphism in the Bible, as well as with what the Hellen had previously stated about the angels, namely that angels and gods are identical. Thus, Macarius does not concentrate on the statues of the gods, but only refers to them briefly. As a result, the interest his response presents for our topic is limited. However, three remarks can be made on the basis of two relevant extracts, number 26 and 27 on the handout. First, Makarios downgrades the statues of the gods from images, icones, to shadows, stiae, and appearances, phasmata. This downgrading is significant. As mentioned above, for the Platonist, the term icon has a precise technical meaning that Deborah Steiner has described as, I'm quoting, a stepping stone pointing to the original that gives the viewer access to a hidden or absent reality. It is therefore to be distinguished from terms such as eidolon, phantasma, skia, which correspond to a deceptive version of the truth. In fact, instead of allowing the spectator to pass from the sensible to the intelligible realm, they rather refer to the passage from the intelligible to the sensible realm, and even to degradation within the sensible realm itself. Second, the idea that the images do not belong to the realm of what truly is, in number 27, is also a well-known Platonic idea going back to Plato's Republic. Third, Makarios accuses the pagans of believing that the divine lurks within the stone and the wood. But this is exactly what his opponent has refuted. It is unlikely that Makarios misunderstands the pagan objection to this degree. After all, he has already answered to the opponent's view, namely that the statues are images, by stating that they are not images, but they are only shadows and appearances. Thus, it seems that here Makarios is simply repeating a standard Christian view against the cult of the statues, irrespectively of his opponent's position. Fourth, antinomies such as containing the uncontainable order, grasping the ungraspable, or giving a tactile form to what cannot be touched, evoke the antithesis between the invisible things and visible forms in the first fragment of Porphyry's De Statuis, number 2 on the handout. But besides this minor indication, which is practically insignificant, there is no hint in Makarios' response allowing us to make out who the opponent might be. However, the case is very different with Makarios' response to the opponent's second objection, which is number 28, but I'm not going to read it, because it's really too long. Makarios begins by denying that the incarnation involves the Logos being subject to passion. Since the opponent refutes the incarnation on the same grounds as the theurgic rite of the animation of statues, the argument which Makarios, in his defense of the incarnation, denies must be the same as the opponent's argument against theurgy. As explained above, the impassibility of the divine is Porphyry's argument against theurgy. Makarios' unnamed opponent must therefore be Porphyry. Porphyry said that the divine is impassible, and thus its processions take place without corruption, being in this opposed to generation, which participates to corruption and change. Number 17 on the handout. Makarios replies that the impassible or alien to passions, pathon allotrion, is not that which is not subject to generation, which is associated with corruption and change, but that which is not ashamed of being born with that which experienced passions, and that which, without taking on the inferiority of evil, elevates the things of the flesh up to his own incorruptibility, aphasia. As Mark Edwards observes, here Makarios evokes a Christological doctrine already found in Athanasius and St. Gregory of Nyssa. To make his claim clearer, Makarios refers to the image of the sun, which, descending into moisture, dries and hardens, without his rays becoming turbid. So too, he says, God the Word, being the intelligible Son, is not caught up in the passions, but on the contrary, he leads the flesh up to the slippery places, anagon that is our cause, and sets it in a divine state of blessedness. To this idea, namely the intelligible light illuminating the flesh, alludes also the verb apostrapti, illuminates, a little bit further at the end of paragraph 15. As Mark Edwards notes in his commentary on this passage, the image of the sun and moisture has, of course, its origin in Plato's Republic. However, the idea of the intelligible light, which illuminates flesh so that the latter participates in divine blessedness, is remarkably reminiscent of the ambiguous theistic principle according to which the primary beings, because of their abundance of power, are in a position to illuminate even the lowest level of reality, so that terrestrial things can participate in the divine, and the earth itself can receive a share in divinity. This is number 29. Thus, it would seem that Macarius put forward against Porphyry an image reminiscent not only of Plato's Republic, but also of the ambiguous mysteries. He then goes on to defend the honorability of human and virginal flesh, which he compares to virgin earth, Parthenos Yi. This comparison is already made by Irenaeus of Lyon, but in Macarius' context, it could also serve to strengthen the parallel with the ambiguous earth, which, because of its perfection and purity and being of good type, is able to receive the divine. But for Macarius, although the earth is honorable, the proof is that God created the man out of muddy water, ambulos ili, making thus the latter the dwelling place of intellect, nous, thoughts, logismi, and the soul, psyche. A human being is more preferable than mortar, and a virgin more honorable than clay. Having thus proven the honorability of the virgin's flesh, Macarius continues by describing the incarnation as God's arranging a temple for himself, without needing human hands or art, statement that which evokes Paul Areopagus speech, and more significantly, he accounts of the incarnation as God's fashioning out of Mary's flesh his own God-bearing statue, Theophoron Agalma, within which he resides, shaking the inhabited world with the thunder of his virtue, and illuminating all with the lightning of the grace of his gift. Here, Macarius reverses Porphyry's objection. Porphyry said that the idea that the gods dwell within their statues is incongruous, and that the incarnation doctrine is even more incongruous. In reply, Macarius shows the consistency of the incarnation, adding that it is equivalent to God's making his own statue and residing within it. In other words, by demonstrating the truth of the incarnation, Macarius also saves theurgy, and more precisely, the theurgic rite of the animation of statues, giving to it, however, a wholly new meaning relevant to the Christian doctrine. I submit that Macarius sets thus the foundations of the Christian concept of theurgia, despite the fact that the word theurgia itself does not occur in the text. Macarius' theurgy is the incarnation, an idea that will be elaborated by Pseudo-Dionysius the Areopagite. But whereas Pseudo-Dionysius is primarily influenced by the works of Proclus, Macarius, writing about a century earlier, creates his concept of theurgia in his attempt to refute Porphyry, who denied the incarnation on the same grounds as theurgy. since Iamblichus had refuted Porphyry's argument against theurgy before Makarios refuted the philosopher's denial of the incarnation, it would have been natural for Makarios to take the Iamblichus' part against Porphyry, using, up to a point, ideas of the Iamblichan origin to refute his opponent. This would have resulted in a new Christian concept of theurgy, grounded on both the Christian and the Neoplatonic Iamblichan traditions. With respect to the latter, in Makarios, the human body of Christ substitutes for Iamblichus' integrated and pure receptacle. On number 7 of the handout. God the Word takes the place of the God who dwells within the statue receptacle. The flesh of Mary takes the place of the sacred, perfect, and godlike materials the statue is made of. God himself substitutes for the theurgist and God's art for the theurgic art. The incarnation is thus a divine work in the strictest sense, since God himself formed his own statue. Similarly, in Iamblichus, theurgy is ultimately a divine work, number 30 and 31. In Christian theurgy, the fulfillment of God's economy, namely man's salvation and return to the previous and fallen state, substitutes for salvation through union with the divine, which is the ultimate goal of pagan theurgy. And the light of the incarnated God the Word, who illuminates all with the lightning and of the grace of his gift, substitutes for the elapses of the pagan gods. As for the reference to the virtue with which the incarnated Logos, dwelling within his uniquely made statue, saves the inhabited world, it might be a subtile final touch on Makarios' refutation of Porphyry. Porphyry thought that the only living statue was the philosopher, who while still embodied could become divine through virtue alone. Number 33. Now the incarnated Logos and the beauty of his virtue substitutes for the philosopher and his virtue. There is no living statue other than the incarnated Logos, the uniquely made God-bearing statue. So, and after all this, I am coming to my conclusion. 2 weeks ago, Gillian Clark presented Augustine saying Porphyry knew better, although he had apparently got a lot wrong, against Iamblichan theurgy. Here, Makarios seems to say the opposite. Iamblichus knew better, although he had apparently got a lot wrong as well, against Porphyry. This opposition evokes Wallis' accurate remark about the orientation of later Neoplatonic thought, namely that Iamblichus' influence was predominant in the Greek-speaking half of the empire, whereas in the West it was Porphyry's influence that predominated. If my suggested reading is correct, the passages from Makarios examined above illustrate this pattern. They also suggest that Makarios' contribution to the Christian appropriation and transformation of Neoplatonism might be a field deserving further research. One century earlier than Pseudo-Dionysius, Makarios understands the incarnation as theurgia. It might therefore be possible to consider him as a ring of the chain going from Iamblichus to Pseudo-Dionysius and further to Grigorios Palamas' mysticism of the divine light, which is the most characteristic expression of the Orthodox Church's positive evaluation of matter. However, I submit that the Eastern Church might not have remained uninfluenced by Porphyry's ideas, but his legacy would extend on another level, relevant to the theoretical foundations on which rests the theology of the religious icon, and more precisely, to the latter status of symbol revealing the invisible God, and to its pedagogical role, summarized in St. John's of Damascus' word, I'm quoting, "The image is a memorial. What an image is to the literate, an image what a book is to the literate, an image is to the illiterate. But this is another story to be told another time.